At around 5 p.m. on the 26th of November 2000, 16-year-old Leanne Tiernan was on her way home after a day of Christmas shopping with her friend Sarah. Leanne's walk should have taken less than 10 minutes, yet she was never seen alive again. The ensuing investigation was the largest in the history of the West Yorkshire Police. Yet the perpetrator lived less than a mile away. This is the tragic case of Leanne Tiernan. I'm Emma Kenny, welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Well, let's talk about today's case, which is one of those. It's just heartbreaking on every single level, of course, like every single case I always do. But it's also one of those that makes you have that unnerving feeling that even when you have that bias for security and you think that you're safe just going about your business, you really don't know who's lurking in the shadows. I'm a mother. Many of you are mothers here. We've all been kids as well. And we've all gone through those periods of time of being concerned about people that we love and having those worries and fears that something might happen to them. But fortunately, for the most part, that never plays out in truth. In reality, our lives carry on. We don't experience and endure the losses that I'm talking about today. But all the fears that Tiernan family would have had would actually play out in reality. So let's talk about Leanne. Leanne Tiernan was born in Leeds on the 27th of September 1984. Leeds is about 35, 36 miles from where I am right now, from where I live. And I know it really, really well. It's a place I love and it's quite a close community. It's big and it has everything that you'd expect from a university city. So it's thriving, it genuinely is. And certainly when Leanne goes missing, it is a pivotal time in Leeds history. You've got the big music scene happening. It's a place where the house scene is thriving. There's a lot of warehouse raves that go on around the environment and area of Leeds. So it's a cool place to be. She was the daughter of Michael Tiernan and Sharon Hawkhead, and she was the younger sister of Michelle Tiernan. She attended West Leeds High School, and she lived in Bramley in Leeds with her mum and her older sister, Michelle. So she is somebody in that dynamic with her mum and her sister, very, very well loved. She was somebody who had apparently a fondness for chocolate. She was incredibly close to her family, and crucially, she had never, ever gone missing from home before. And that is so pivotal when we talk about cases like we are doing today, because when a child disappears, and at 16, I know that you're an older teenager, but you are still a kid. At the end of the day, you have no life experience. And if your parents are used to you coming in at a certain time and you don't, they think about your habits. If you are not somebody who has disappeared before, if you're not somebody who doesn't arrive home on time, immediately it's going to cause concern, and it should, because when people fail to stick to those habits that are just absolutely accepted and normalized, it tends to mean that something has happened. Now, often it can be an innocent explanation, but I think that any parent out there will have gone through a moment of dread when a child hasn't arrived at the exact moment that they're meant to be home or a little bit before. Because the minute that it goes past the time they're meant to be home, you start imagining all the worst case scenarios. And that's because you are used to a formula and habit base of your child's actions. When they stray out of that, it's often for a good reason, such as they have been hurt or there is a problem. And I'm not saying these things are massively serious. I'm saying that when they go outside of that normal parameter, you tend to get afraid because you know that it usually signals something bad has happened. Now, Leanne is last seen alive at 4:50 p.m. on Sunday the 26th of November 2000. The day had played out like so many teenagers' days had played out. She'd gone off with her 15-year-old friend Sarah Whitehouse shopping. She'd returned to Bramley by bus. They'd been basically Christmas shopping in Leeds city centre. They didn't get home late, and Leanne had basically promised to be home in time for dinner at 5 p.m. And she was certainly going down that line and route that would mean that she would indeed be home for that time. So the two girls, they parted at Huffley Lane. Sarah actually last recalled Leanne setting off along an unlit path through an area of wooded wasteland known as Huffley Gill. So that was the last time that she basically saw a friend. And the walk from the bus stop to Leanne's home is around 3/4 of a mile. So biggie, And this is very normal for young people to go home and do the routes that they're used to and walk, etc. This is not something left field. It's not somebody putting themselves in a dangerous situation. All of us as teenagers will have walked home at some point. And sometimes you have to cut through areas that might be a little bit remote. We don't expect that anything bad is going to happen to us, nor should we have to feel that way. Now, when Sarah actually got home, she called Leanne's home and was actually really surprised because she found out that Leanne wasn't there and she was fully expecting that she'd have got home by then. And Leanne's mum's worried. So by 5:20 p.m., she's ringing her mobile phone to find out where she is. The phone did ring out for some time, but then it got cut off. She then rang again. And at this point, it was cut off after 4 rings. And you can imagine, can't you? At that point, you're going to be going absolutely frantic because you're going to think to yourself, hang on a minute, if it's gone after 4 rings, yeah, it could be that the battery's died, or it could be that somebody's purposefully and willfully cut that off. And why would her daughter do that? She wasn't in any trouble. There was no problems at home. There was no reason for her to do that. So you automatically start thinking, my God, what if somebody has got my daughter's phone? And what does that mean about what's happened to my daughter? We get to 7 p.m. She rings the police at this point to say my daughter Leanne is missing. And immediately they know this is something that is very concerning because they do not feel that this is within keeping as far as Leanne's behaviour is concerned. So it immediately feels like there's something potentially sinister that's occurred. They start this missing person inquiry. It's led by Detective Superintendent Chris Gregg. And as the inquiry progresses, it actually became the largest that the West Yorkshire Police have ever undertaken. It involved 200 officers. It had hundreds of volunteers. Like I said, Leeds is a really friendly area. It's very community orientated. And I do fully understand that the minute that they are in a situation where a young person is missing, there are going to be reams of people coming out to support. It's just the makeup of the mentality of the people who live there. The investigation was really well supported as well. So it received help from the British Waterways, from British Transport Police, the Ministry of Defence, Interpol, amongst others as well. And the police are basically pleading with the public for information because they know that time is of the essence. They know that this is totally out of character for Leanne, and therefore it is strongly suspected that foul play may have occurred. They put out a statement saying Leanne was 5'4". She was slim. She had a ring in her left eyebrow. She's wearing a blue jacket, a black and white polo neck, black trousers and black boots, that she'd last been seen shortly before 5 p.m. carrying a small Argos Elizabeth Duke bag, which contained a gold wishbone ring and titanium button bar. So they're putting out this information, hoping that somebody from the local community is going to come forward and say that they had sightings of her. Police then begin with the search of the area that Leanne was last seen. So they're going through lots of foliage, lots of brambles, etc. in Huffley Gill. They find nothing. They did more than 1,400 house-to-house inquiries, which is enormous. They did over 800 houses along Leanne's probable route, which the police named the Red Route. They were all searched, and there was about a half-mile radius around that was searched. That included things like sheds, garages, outbuildings. They really flooded in trying to find any avenue that could lead them to unearth some information about where Leanne could have gone. The police also searched 142 commercial premises within that half mile radius. The West Yorkshire Police Underwater Search Unit, they carried out a search of a 3 mile section of the Leeds and Liverpool Canal, which is enormous, isn't it? Just think about that. A huge amount of manpower required and a huge amount of diligence. So that was between Spring Garden Lock and Bramley Falls, 2 miles of which were drained to the depth of 1 meter. So they were absolutely going for it in trying to find out what happened to Leanne. The unit also searched 32 drain shafts in the area, and Yorkshire Water were also called in to help locate disused and abandoned wells in the area. Also, they stopped the collections of household waste. So they actually put a stop on people having the refuse collected because they wanted to be able to have time to search bins for evidence. So you've got to give it to West Yorkshire Police at this point. They are not leaving any stone unturned. At one stage, the police did come across something that was very worrying. So they found a balaclava in the woods, which immediately, when you're thinking about a child's gone missing and somebody doesn't want to be identified, maybe they would be disguised in balaclava. So at this point, they check the saliva that they find in the mask. but the DNA actually belonged to a local burglar, so they eliminated him pretty quickly from the inquiry. The police also, during that search, found 6 mobile phones. None of them belonged to Leanne. They also found an umbrella. Ironically, they found an Elizabeth Duke bag, literally the exact one that Tien had, but it didn't actually belong to her. The police then did their due diligence around sex offenders. So they found 36 sex offenders living in the area, which is pretty terrifying, isn't it? 36 known sex offenders living in that radius. But within several days, they'd managed to eliminate every single one of them as suspects. So this was done by going into the houses, looking for any signs of Leanne, also looking at whether there was any DNA of hers, any clothes, any hair clips, etc. But to no avail. DNA samples were taken from 140 men who were interviewed by the police. So they were really going through the motions of ensuring that they spoke to as many potential suspects as possible. And again, it's turning up nothing. They even executed 12 search warrants at different addresses throughout Leeds. And every single one of them just ends up cold. They're not getting any further in why Leanne has disappeared and where she is now. We get to the 3rd of December 2000. This is when the police stage a reconstruction of Leanne's last movements. This was actually reenacted by Sarah Whitehouse and Leanne's older sister, Michelle. So Leanne's older sister basically plays her younger sister. And the whole hope of this is, of course, to jog someone's memory of any potential witnesses, because reconstructions are powerful. We have Crime Watch in the UK. They do a lot of reconstructions when they do their series in the UK. And I'm sure that a lot of countries have got their own examples of Crime Watch. But one of the things that is very powerful is they put together the last sightings of victims. And the hope is that when somebody is tuning into a TV show and they're watching this play out in front of them, they're reminded of a tiny bit of information they may have thought was inconsequential at the time, and then they hand that over to the police, and all of a sudden that's the missing piece of the jigsaw. But it would be very challenging for Michelle to have to play her sister in this situation, particularly psychologically being aware that the reason that she's doing it is because her sister is likely dead. Detectives actually sent messages as well to Leanne's phone, which was now switched off, but it had been briefly activated on the 27th of November 2000. Also, a lovely local businessman, a guy called Sean Clark, he offers a £10,000 reward for any information that can lead to Leanne's safe return. Iceland, the shop, not the country, by the way, they went ahead and printed Leanne's picture and her details on milk cartons that they sold in the stores nationwide. So again, this real pulling together. Everybody wants to bring Leanne home. And I can imagine as well, as every day passes, her family are becoming more and more concerned that there is a strong likelihood she's never coming home as they would wish her to. I know that it's an awful reality for families to have to come to terms with the fact that they may get their loved one back, but not alive, is something that they have to manage moment to moment as that becomes a sadder reality. There were a lot of unconfirmed reports of sightings. So these sightings were as far away as Doncaster, Blackpool, and her parents are just desperately trying to keep advocating to keep Leanne's name in the press. We all know just how powerful PR is. We all know how quickly the news changes onto the next subject and the next subject. And when you've got a missing child, that can't happen. Your child needs to be that subject ad infinitum until you know what's happened to them. So both Sharon Hawkhead and Michael Tiernan, who are her parents, they're out there trying their best to help in the media to get people to be aware that she's still missing, just being willing to speak out constantly about their daughter not being home to keep that press involved. Michael, her father, said, "I can't believe this is happening. It's a nightmare. It's totally out of character." And of course, Sharon, she said that she just had so many fears. She said that she believed that her daughter had been abducted. And she said that if my daughter hadn't been abducted, there is no way she wouldn't have been in touch with me. She would never have done that to us. On the 20th of December, Sharon, Leanne's mum, made this really tearful appeal. And she just said, "I want my daughter home for Christmas." She said, "The last 25 days have been dreadful. I've lurched from despair to hysteria. But I know we've got to keep going. If somebody has her against her will, for God's sake, let her go." Leanne's boyfriend, Wayne Keeley, who was a 19-year-old care assistant. He was just pleading with her to get in touch. He couldn't believe it. He wasn't a suspect in any way, shape or form. All he knows is his girlfriend went out shopping and she's never been seen since. On the 4th of December 2000, the police release an eFit facial composite of a man who'd been seen walking a dog in the Huffley Gill area shortly before Leanne disappeared. He was described as being 5'8" tall, relatively stocky build, with a round reddish face that may possibly be scarred. He was apparently wearing a black wooden hat, a three-quarter length waterproof jacket, and dirty jeans, but nobody came forward. And that trail, regarding her disappearance, regarding what potentially had played out, it went cold for 9 months. I don't even want to try to imagine how terrifying, how frustrating, how distressing, how utterly life-draining that would have been for Leanne's family. She's just disappeared. 9 months. No new leads. Nothing coming to fruition. Just the absolute presence of Leanne's absence. Sadly, that wasn't going to continue. And I say sadly because ultimately no one wants to have the reality of what they feared brought into sharp focus. You always want hope. You always want to believe that that person is going to come home, that maybe a miracle is going to occur. But in this case, that's thwarted on the 20th of August 2001. Leanne's body is found by a guy called Mark Bisson. He was walking his two dogs in Lily Woods, that's in North Yorkshire, and he came across her body. It was only 100 yards, actually, from where another murder victim, a girl called Yvonne Fitt, had been discovered buried in 1992, which is just uncanny that two women's bodies were found in that spot. Detective Superintendent Greg announced that the inquiry had now become a murder, and the investigation became known as Operation Conifer. That was the code name for it. One of the things that they noted about Leanne's body was, first of all, it was encased in 10 green bin liners, and they said that she was wrapped up, quote, like a Russian doll. That was according to Chris Gregg, the lead investigator. He said that the killer had tied a bin liner with black twine and then used another bin liner the opposite way around Leanne's head. There was also another bin liner secured with a leather dog collar. Then she'd been placed inside this floral pattern double quilt duvet. Leanne's hands were tied behind her back with three cable ties, one around each wrist and one linking the two, they said, like a daisy chain. Also, a dark coloured scarf was also wrapped around her neck. Leanne's hair was actually still tied in a ponytail with the same band and hair clips that she'd been wearing when she disappeared. So even though all this time has passed, her hair is in the same condition that it was the day that she disappeared. Also, they noted that Leanne's coat and black boots were not actually found at the scene. So it doesn't sound like she died there. It sounds like she's been placed there, and it feels like a time period has passed, and yet her body is not in a serious state of decomposition to the point where her hair, etc., still looks and retains the style it was and had on the day that she disappeared. The police at this point make a public appeal for anybody who might have been in Lindley Woods recently because they might have seen somebody acting suspiciously. They asked anybody, in fact, who regularly visited the area to just come forward, just to come and speak to them. Because, of course, a lot of time has passed and yet they feel like they might be dealing with something that's occurred quite recently. It's a quandary. Now, Lindley Woods is far from Bramley, so the police felt that it was likely that the person who killed Leanne must have known the area relatively well. It wasn't somebody who'd just taken a chance on dumping the body there. They'd specifically chosen that area. And after this appeal, actually somebody did come forward and say that they had seen a man trying to get a bundle of something out of the boot of his car in Lindley Woods. Leanne was actually identified formally 2 days after her remains were discovered. They did that through her fingerprints. Obviously, at this point, as I noted, we have now an open investigation relating to murder as opposed to missing. The autopsy was conducted by Alison Fendley, and it was quite frustrating. They found minimal forensic evidence on her body. The killer left no DNA, but what they did find was a small tuft of red carpet fibres found on Leanne's back. Now, the state of decomposition, that led Fendley to believe that Leanne's body had been frozen. That's why her hair was still in the same style. That's why time had passed and decomposition wasn't obvious, because she had been frozen. And then she believed that in the last few weeks, that's when Leanne's body was finally dumped. They brought in a cryobiology expert who was there to examine Leanne's cardiac tissue, and they concluded that she was indeed frozen, and they were able to conclude that she was frozen in a domestic freezer, not an industrial one. Isn't it amazing how hugely advanced we are getting? I mean, this is going back to 2000, bear in mind, and they're bringing in experts like that who can literally tell you whether you've been frozen in an industrial or a domestic one. So it just is staggering how effective these experts are in being able to diligently explore how somebody has been stored, in this case, how Leanne's body was stored. Because clearly, if you're hearing about somebody being stored in a domestic freezer, you're thinking, that's likely going to have been the perpetrator's freezer. And that likely indicates that potentially there is an address where that freezer may exist, or where those red tufts of carpet may exist, because certainly the indicator is it's domestic, not industrial. Now the autopsy has been completed, Leanne's body was given back to her family, given back to the people who adore her, and her funeral was held on September the 28th. That was the day after what should have been her 17th birthday. They were burying her instead of celebrating her. She never even got to be an official adult because this killer stole her life in this barbaric way. Her family and friends held the service at Sandford Methodist Church in Bramley, Leeds. They had this floral tribute that had the words, "Night, night, baby." During the service, they played November Rain. I'm sure a lot of you, like me, loved Guns N' Roses back in the day, and it's a very beautiful tune, even though it still comes from quite a heavy metal band. They also played some of Leanne's favourite hymns, "Ye Shall Go Out With Joy" and "Give Me Oil In My Lamp." Deaconess sister, Janet Durbin, she led the service. She spoke out about the late Leanne. She described her as being a normal, happy, fun-loving teenager, half child and half young lady. She spoke about how Leanne loved to spend time with her grandparents and loved walking to church on Sunday morning. She was considered to be a special member of the church family. Leanne was nicknamed Chocolate Chip Niece by one of her uncles because she loved chocolate immensely. The deaconess said, "You're naturally sad because you won't physically see Leanne again. Whether you knew her as a daughter, granddaughter, sister or niece, she was always a friend. Whatever your memories are, cherish them. They're like gifts that no one can take away from you." It's very hard when a child has died to say anything of comfort, but I do think there was a beauty in those sentiments and words. Now, as I've said, North Yorkshire Police were very invested in this case. They wanted to find the killer, and I would say they go above and beyond to make sure that that becomes a reality. So let's look at the forensics. They got the bags and cables. They tested for forensics at this point to see if there was any DNA. They found nothing. But what they did find was three different manufacturers for the cable ties. So all of those cable ties had an actual code for where they were made and distributed. One of them was yellow, so Royal Mail was apparently a major customer for yellow cable ties. There was a really big Royal Mail outlet in Leeds. Plastic bin liners, they discovered, were manufactured in the northeast, and they found that one of their major outlets was Morrison's Supermarkets, and the major supermarket in Bromley is Morrison's, so that proved, as far as they were concerned, the theory that the killer was local. Also, they found dog hairs inside the duvet, and they found a dog collar around her neck. So when they looked at that dog collar, they actually found they were manufactured by Armitages in Nottingham, and like hundreds and thousands of these dog collars had actually been manufactured. But detectives asked in every single pet shop in Leeds if they had sold a tan Armitage dog collar, and if so, who to? But Sadly, at this point, nobody could tell the police anything, but it's incredible that the police were literally fingertip searching in every way, shape or form. I mean, this is old style policing, isn't it? They are just diligently going and asking people, do they have any access to this information? Have they sold this particular item? And they're just doing it in a way that day after day is bringing them potentially closer to Leanne's killer. So when they get no joy from the actual pet shops, they then ask the wholesalers about this particular dog collar, because obviously there are hundreds of thousands of dog collars that are sold, but turns out there was only 114 that sold this type of dog collar. So even though that's a lot, we're reducing the number. Now, the 112th company that the police spoke to was named Pets Pajamas. It's based in the Merseyside. They were one of the first UK companies to actually do online orders. And they said to the police, yeah, we sold an Armitage tan dog collar. Not just we sold an Armitage tan dog collar. We sold it to Mr. John Taylor at Cockshot Drive in Armley. Now, Armley is the next town over from Bramley. Is it just me who gets like those chills in those moments where you're like, think about that person, 112th. And they strike lucky, not just with the fact that they've sold a dog collar of this nature, but they've recorded who it's sold to, it's local to where the murder victim lived, and now they've got a name and address. So the company then give the police Taylor's phone number and postcode. So now they have someone in their sights, John Taylor. Now, who is John Taylor? So he was born on the 27th of August, 1956. He was born in Leeds. He was actually a parcel delivery worker of a parcel force. He lived within half a mile of where Leanne was last seen. He was also known locally as the Pet Man, which I think sounds quite endearing, but is as far away from the kind of character that we're going to describe today. He was known as the Pet Man because he had over 30 pets in his house, which basically makes him an animal hoarder. Let's just say it as it is. 30 pets in a small home is going to be a problem. And these included dogs, they included ferrets. So I can only begin to imagine how his home smelt. There will be somebody listening to this now with 75 animals in an absolutely perfect home. I get it. There are anomalies. But can we just go down the law of reason when it comes down to most people with 30 animals in their home? There's going to be an impact on the hygiene. And there is when it comes down to John Taylor. Also, this guy sold pet food. So again, that's why he's got this particular moniker. Now, his only previous conviction was actually for the theft of a suit when he was 15 years of age. And even though that seems unrelated, please let's think about what we expect to see in the history of violent offenders, particularly when we think about individuals who are sexual sadists and become serial killers, for example, criminal behaviour. They graduate. It starts off small, it gets big. He was also considered by his neighbours to be trustworthy and ordinary. But there again, Dennis Rader. BTK, everyone thought he was a brilliant guy. Devoted family man, lovely colleague. We all know what he got up to in his spare time. Now, Taylor's name, ironically, had come up previously in Leanne's investigation. So following the appeal for information, two people who were former girlfriends had actually given police his name. They'd actually met him through the Lonely Hearts columns. Yes, back in the day, where people would write into the classified ads in the newspapers and ask to meet people. These days, I think it's been overtaken by Grindr and Tinder, but back then it was quite a positive and possible way to meet people. Anyway, this is what he'd done, and he basically connected with both of those women. And whilst he was seeing them, he would boast about weird things. Like, he would talk about how he liked to poach, and he was very specific in saying that he used to go poaching in Lindley Woods regularly. So we've got a lot of connections now, bearing in mind Leanne's body is found in Lindley Woods. So the police start doing some inquiries into his background, and they do turn up that he's quite a frequent user of Lonely Hearts advertisements. So these two women that he's been in a relationship with, it's fitting together that what they're saying is true. They're not just spurned exes. They are giving information across because essentially it's resonated with them. And clearly it's resonated that he might be the kind of person who could harm Leanne, because There must be something in their relationships that they've had that has sparked some concerns about the kind of human being that Taylor is. Now, through his telephone records, police actually identified the women who he'd contacted in this way and began interviewing them all, because obviously two have come forward, but there'll be more. Now, one woman who dated Taylor said that he had some odd kinks, shall we say. So he had this particular desire to tie women up and to lock them in cupboards. Another said that Taylor had this fetish for bondage, whips and ties. And of course, BDSM, when it's in consenting couples, is completely acceptable. It's a known kink. But we're not talking about the women potentially enjoying it in this case. It made them feel deeply uncomfortable at times. Also, he told this particular individual he wanted to tie her daughter up with cable ties and have sex with her. At that point, I can imagine several uses for cable ties and Taylor's neck. Just throwing it out there. Can you imagine actually saying that to an ex? Obviously, he was in a relationship with him at the time, but just going to throw it out there. You might like the odd slap. You might like the odd whip. I don't know. Do whatever you will. Whatever turns you on, as long as it's consenting and enjoyed by both parties. Crack on, as long as you don't damage yourself too badly. Always have a safe word. But at the end of the day, even if you're into it, you know, and you like all of that stuff, I don't know, you're hanging by your nipples from clamps to the ceiling. The minute that the guy you're seeing says, by the way, I want to zip tie your daughter and have sex with her too, I swear to God, you'd hope that I was clamped to the ceiling, because otherwise you better be a fast runner and you better be able to dodge items that are coming at your head. It's not exactly a boundary that most adults in any way, shape or form would accept being breached. It's a bizarre fantasy, even if it was just a fantasy, even if it was just a realm of fantasy. The minute a man brings in the potential of using your child as a sexual object is the minute they are ousted from your life, if you have even an ounce of sense. Also, a former girlfriend of him recalled that he would go to Lindley Woods when they were actually dating. They'd both gone to Lindley Woods rabbit hunting there, and Taylor had been to Lindley Woods in his youth on scout camps as well, so he knew the area brilliantly. She said as well that she broke the relationship off because she felt when he was having sex with her that she was being raped. She didn't feel like it was a mutually enjoyed experience. It was him using her however he chose to use her. And when she was asked by the police to describe how Taylor would tie her up, she said he'd secure plastic cable ties around each of her wrists, then tie her hands behind her back by using a third tie to link them, which is a signature when you think about the crime, because that's exactly how Leanne was found. In fact, she said that Taylor kept a bundle of cable ties in the drawer next to his bed, which is harrowing. And two other women said that Taylor really enjoyed bondage during sex and had even bound their breasts and hands with cable ties. So the police do feel at this point they've got probable cause to search the house. He's living alone when they execute this. And at this point, he's also arrested on suspicion of murder on the 16th of October 2001. So they seal off his house, seal off his gardens, they excavate the gardens. And when they're searching his house, their first thing that they know is that he is literally living in squalor. It is disgusting. It stinks. It is literally ridden with insects and decomposition. It is everything that is your worst nightmare to entertain when you're having to search a home. They find a freezer in the kitchen. They also find a newspaper with the headline about police closing in on Leanne's killer. And we all know people of a certain mindset criminally like to feel involved in the investigation. They can't help it. It feeds them seeing how far the police have come, knowing they're still free. It makes them feel excited. It makes them feel that they're involved to some degree. And it also makes them feel like maybe they're still one step ahead, even though ultimately it just means the net is closing in. The police also note that there's no carpet down. They see that nails, however, in the floorboards have red fibres. Remember those red fibres that were on Leanne's back? Well, they matched them. Also on one nail was a shard of green plastic. Guess what they matched? Exactly. the bin liners that Leanne was encased in. They also found cable ties in the back garden, and of course they matched the cable ties used to bind Leanne's. They also found other Armitage dog collars, so again, another connection. And then another piece of evidence that clearly connected him to Leanne was the presence of distinct pollen that was found in Leanne's hair, in her nasal cavity, and on her skin. So they used this forensic pollen analysis to determine that the pollen had actually come from Taylor's garden. So further proof that she'd been at his house shortly before she disappeared. And clearly, the evidence is mounting up now to suggest that not only did she die there, the likelihood is she was stored there for multiple months. Now, remember before I said that there was an e-fit created because a witness had seen a dog walker? Well, that same witness had identified the dog that the walker was walking, and the dog was a terrier. And the police actually found that there was a dog buried in the backyard along with two other dogs, and indeed, it was a terrier. And what's even worse is that terrier had had its head saved in with a meat cleaver. He'd murdered his dog. So this guy is an absolute out-and-out psychopath. He's not the pet guy that people think. He's not the nice neighbour. He's bringing animals into his home and he's killing them. And now he's graduated and he's killed Leanne. When it comes down to the interview, he initially denies any knowledge. I don't know anything. I know nothing. Do you know nothing? I know nothing. Absolutely nothing. Are you sure you know nothing? I know nothing. Absolutely nothing. The thing is, we've got all this evidence mounting that says that it's definitely you. Well, what kind of evidence would that be? Well, it's the red fibres from your carpet that was found on the victim. Also, it's the pollen that's specific to your back garden. On top of that, we've got the actual collar that's identified as being bought by you, that's literally got a digital connector to the original purchasing scenario. Also, that was found on the victim. Do you want me to go on? No, not really. No, that sounds pretty watertight. But I'm just going to say I know nothing, because that's what we do in these circumstances, isn't it? Anyway, classic. Denies any knowledge. Not had anything to do with Liam's disappearance. Said he hadn't been to Huffley Gill in years. Not been there for years. I have not been there for years. As if that is any kind of way of rebuffing the suggestion that you're involved. I'm sorry, it couldn't be me. Why couldn't it be you? Well, I've not been there for years. Oh, God, I can't believe it. Another person that we've got to count out because they've specifically said they haven't been there. Don't you think we should maybe investigate that they haven't been there before we just throw it out? No. What would happen if we were to go about investigating everybody who said that they haven't been somewhere when we think they might have? Instead, we've just got to accept the word. That's what we do. Imagine if it worked that way. Nothing would ever get solved. But essentially, this is his line of defence. I have never been to Huffley Gill in years. Anyway, they confront him with all the evidence because it's tons. And at that point, he's like, ah, I sound a bit bang to rights there. It sounds a little bit like I'm obviously the suspect and obviously the perpetrator. So what am I going to do in this circumstance? So then he's immediately considering his options, isn't he? He's got a short amount of time to come up with an idea of why he can accept that she was present, but that he's not actually responsible. So he thinks, I'm going to go down the minimization route. Now, this is what most violent predators do. They're like, it wasn't really as bad as what it says. Sounds really bad. It sounds really bad. It does say it sounds really bad. It does. Sounds really bad. But it's not quite as bad as you think it is. Is it not really as bad as I think? No. It's nearly as bad, but not quite as bad. Okay, go on. Tell me what happened. I did kidnap her. I did. Yeah, that's really bad. Before we even go any further, we're just going to take you to the elevator and send you forthwith. But, you know, this is what he does. He says, okay, I kidnapped her, which is what we've all done. If we haven't been out walking the dog and thought, I'll just kidnap a stranger. When you think about the list of the most predatory type of humans, the most dangerous that walk amongst us, it's that type. The kind of person who abducts you. There's no positive outcome to an individual who is going to abduct you. The worst bit is, the best thing you can hope for is some horrific sexual experience that will scar you. Or, one further than that, you'll be kept hostage and used horribly tortured potentially for months and then maybe freed. My God, that's what you could cling on to. But for the most part, some Jews coming to abduct you is not going to let you go. It's not in the abductor's playbook. It's their first stage of carrying out their violent fantasy. But he's like, yeah, I was just out there walking my dog at the entrance to Huffley Gill and I thought to myself, I'm going to take a girl today. Literally, that's what he said. As if that's going to make sense to anybody. Yeah, I'm just going to take a girl today. So he went into the Gill apparently with that in mind. He hid in the foliage like an absolute predator beyond belief. And apparently Leanne was just simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. So Taylor was there waiting in the dark. As soon as she walks past, he grabs her, tells her not to scream. Then he took off his large Parcel Force coat and he puts her on Leanne because obviously he's disguising her. And then he blindfolded her with his scarf, ties her hand behind her back with his dog lead. And then he led her for 22 minutes across open lands and roads to his house. Can you imagine the fear that Leanne had to go through, knowing ultimately there was a strong likelihood she was walking to her death? Because I do not for one minute believe that she would not have thought that way. Our human desire is to believe it and hope. The psychology of survival is to believe that maybe it will be okay. But I also think below that is the true subtext that runs through your veins, a sense of impending doom. That walk took Leanne to an area just outside the police search radius, just outside. Now, inside his house, Taylor apparently had this old church two-seater pew in his kitchen and he sat Leanne on that. Then he said he was going to get some whiskey and he said to her, I'm going to take you upstairs and I'm going to rape you, which would have been harrowing beyond belief. She's 16. Then, as he's taking her upstairs, he said her phone rang four times. He said that as he turned around, Leanne's blindfold basically slipped. She saw his face. This made him afraid, so he grabbed her. She apparently at this point was on the bed and she fell off the bed, banged her head on the floor and died. I mean, if that happened, falling off the bed and banging your head literally killed you, most people wouldn't make it past the age of 8. Everyone as a kid has fallen off the bed and banged their head. It's just what you do. In fact, it's probably the one reason why our skulls are so hard and thick. It's because of the fact that we're always banging it and we need to protect our brain. The idea that a 16-year-old, vital, healthy young woman is going to fall off the bed, not from a particularly high height, bang her head and die is inconceivable. If you were thrown hard against something very hard at force and speed, of course, but you don't die that way. So at this point, Taylor says, now he's dealing with a dead body. So he'd gone over to her, he picked her up by the scarf that was wrapped around her neck. And at this point, she died. Yeah, she just died, just casually falling off the bed. He said it was an absolute accident. Absolute accident. He didn't intend for it to happen. You know, he didn't intend for it to happen, guys. He didn't intend to. Just like, let's just work that through. So what were you doing? What were you doing out of that day? I was just looking for somebody to kidnap. You were looking for a girl to kidnap. I was looking for a girl to kidnap and take home. What did you intend to do with her? Well, I intended to abduct her and to rape her. And now she's dead. Yes, but I didn't intend that. I intended to abduct her, rape her, and then, you know, just probably let her go. That's not ringing true, is it? If she hadn't seen my face, she wouldn't have fell off the bed. Really, when it comes down to it, is it actually my fault or is it her fault? Or is it whoever rang four times fault? Because essentially that's really the precursor to her accidental death. I'm just going to go and get the dogs. What? Yeah, I'm just going to go and get the dogs. Why are you going to get some dogs? They're really big dogs, they're beautiful dogs, the German Shepherds, we've got a couple of Dobermen. Actually, I think one of the Dobermans is actually in the film The Omen, but actually not in the film, in the actual real Omen. So I'm just going to go and get them. Why? You'll find out. Why are you putting pedigree chum all over my body and sprinkling biscuits around me? All in time, my child, all in time. Sorry, again, I've gone off on some fantasy experience of what would play out there. But yeah, apparently Leanne died by mistake. So after she died, he'd basically panicked. So he buried her body in Lindley Woods. Now, bear in mind, he's very avoidant when he's asked during these questions. He's not forthcoming, so he doesn't answer questions about the scarf that was around her neck that was clearly used to choke her. You know, he's just saying he just lifted her up that way. He also wasn't forthcoming with the fact that Leanne's body had clearly been frozen for up to 9 months. Now, when the police challenge him on the story and say this version of events doesn't make sense, he says, okay, first of all, I did actually keep the body hidden underneath pallets in my back garden. Then I stored it inside the sofa, which is just bizarre, isn't it, to even conceive that he'd do that. But the police believed that Taylor had actually only taken Leanna out of the freezer in his kitchen, not because he wanted to dump her body, but because it had actually broken down. So the likelihood is that broke down. He didn't know what to do at that moment in time. He's got a dead body that's going to decompose quickly, and now he feels like he has to act. So essentially, he kept her there all this time knowing there was this dead girl that he'd killed in his freezer. And I think that comes down to the psychology of power and domination. I think she is the memento, right? She is what he's kept. We see serial killers take certain things from people and they want to anchor back to that moment. And I appreciate it's hard to get rid of a dead body, but this guy is adept at killing things and murdering animals, so he would know what to do to remove Leanne's body should he wish to do so. Also, he's a delivery driver, so he's got the opportunity to be driving around different places without any suspicion. It makes more sense that he kept her there because he felt that now she was his. He was denying anybody else having access to her, anybody having closure over this case, her family going crazy knowing that Leanne was out there somewhere, whatever form she was in. And he was excited, without a doubt, by that power. And people who'd actually been in his house said that Taylor used to have this really large upright freezer in the kitchen and it suddenly disappeared. So he's disposed of her now, but it seems like only because he had to. We get to the trial. It's the 15th of February, 2002. Taylor appears at this point before Mr. Justice Poole at Leeds Crown Court. He entered a guilty plea on kidnapping, and at this point he was remanded in custody awaiting trial. We get to the 8th of July 2002, and on the first day of Taylor's trial, he pleaded suddenly guilty to murdering Leanne Tiernan. Of course he did. Of course he did. He's banged to rights. He would always have got guilty. All he's trying to do now is mitigate the length of sentence. It's all about him protecting himself. He was actually sentenced on the same day. Judge Astor, when it came down to the sentencing remarks, did actually tear Taylor a new arsehole, in my opinion. He said, "You were not acting on impulse. You chose a secluded place and a vulnerable young girl who suited your purposes. This was as cold and calculating as can be imagined. You are a dangerous sexual sadist. Your purpose in kidnapping this young girl was so that you could satisfy your perverted cravings. The suffering you caused her and the suffering you continue to cause those who loved her simply cannot be measured. You must expect to spend the rest of your life in custody." Can there be cheerleaders at this point? That kind of a summing up is the kind of summing up I like when sentencing remarks are passed. You know, it states the severity, the gravity, and, as far as the judge is concerned, the intention that judge has about the potential freedom of this perpetrator. So at this sentencing, he was basically given a full life tariff. He was told he was going to get a mandatory term of life imprisonment, but it didn't stick. So his sentence was later set at a minimum of 20 years by the Lord Wolf. So this means that Taylor had not been issued a whole life tariff, and that could also mean that he would be released early, which should never happen, because these kind of killers don't change. However, there are other convictions, and it makes sense, because this ain't his first rodeo. Seriously, I'm not minimising, I'm being clear. This ain't his first rodeo. This is a guy who knew what he was doing. There was no DNA on her body. This is a guy who is adept at what he is doing. So the police are really concerned. They think this man is likely a predator who's been going around for a period of time. We need to find more victims. Potentially, we need to solve more murder cases. So now the police have got Taylor's DNA, they start reviewing other local unsolved sex attacks because forensic evidence was still available for DNA extraction with certain cases. So on the 18th of October, 1988, there was a 32-year-old woman attacked as she walked across Huffleygill. She was going to basically get her kids from school. Taylor was there, wearing a mask, armed with a knife. He forced her to commit oral sex and then he raped her. 1st of March, 1989, again, he's masked, he's wielding a knife, breaks into the home of a 21-year-old woman in the middle of broad daylight, forces her into the bedroom, undresses her, blindfolds her, gags her, forces her to commit oral sex and then rapes her. Her child was present in the house at the time. So now they've got two other cases they've solved and he is the perpetrator. So he's rearrested in October 2002. Obviously, he's in prison, but nonetheless, he's now formally charged with the sexual assaults. Now, initially, he refuses to cooperate with the police, but the DNA is overwhelming, so it's irrelevant. Then on the 4th of February 2003, he ends up pleading guilty to both rapes at Leeds Crown Court. Judge Norman Jones, he sentenced him at this point to 2 terms of life imprisonment and expressly disapplied early release provisions. Amen to that. This guy can't walk the streets ever again. Then there's more convictions. So Taylor was known to have travelled across the country to meet women that he'd contacted through personal ads and also through his parcel delivery work. So the police at this point say that it's likely Taylor could have been a serial sex attacker for 20 years leading up to his arrest. That's how long he's potentially got away with it. On the 26th of October 2018, Taylor was told he would spend the rest of his life in prison for 16 offences against 5 victims between 1977 and 1996. This included an indecent assault on a 7-year-old girl. He tied her to the drainpipe of a church in Bramley in 1984 and violated her. What I would like to do to this man, I cannot say on this channel. There is no channel that would likely let me say what I would like to do to this man. I'm just saying, if there happened to be a job that the government could give me where I could deal quietly and legally with these issues, no torture involved, not the kind of person who'd want to torture anybody, just dealing with it quickly, then I'm your girl. I have conscience, I wouldn't enjoy it. It would just be seen as a dutiful job to do. 7. She was 7. So this guy is a sexual predator and threat to anybody of any age. It's as simple as that. Taylor also confessed to holding a knife to the throat of a 27-year-old woman whilst she was walking with her 3 children and he forced her to perform a sex act on him whilst doing that. Judge Mayer said Taylor was responsible for a 20-year campaign of rape and assault against women and children fueled by a sadistic desire to inflict pain for sexual gratification. He is indeed a sexual sadist of the highest level. Taylor is currently imprisoned at HM Prison Wakefield. It's considered one of the worst prisons to ever end up at, so good. I know that he's going to have some fun neighbours to share his time with. Detective Superintendent Chris Greggs insisted for decades that Leanne's murder was not the first major crime that Taylor committed. And as he said, we cannot exclude the possibility that he has killed before. Now, they actually, as a direct result of Leanne's investigation, reopened several murder investigations in 2015. So the murder investigations into Deborah Alison Wood, she was 20. Her body was found burning near Burley Park Station in Leeds. Police believe that her body had likely been kept in cold storage. She was actually found wrapped in bin bags and bedding. Then there was Yvonne Fitch, she was 33. Her body was found in Linley Woods in September 1992, and she had been missing since January 1992. Also, Lindsay Rimmer, she was 13. She disappeared from her home in November 1994. Her body was found at the bottom of a canal 5 months later. So again, another one that they looked at solving. Rebecca Hall, she was 19 when she disappeared on the 13th of April 2001. Her body was found in an alley behind a car park in Bradford on the 26th of April 2001. Then Strathclyde Police, they reopened a murder investigation of 5 Glasgow sex workers. So Diane McNally, she was murdered in October 1991. Karen McGregor, she was 26. She was murdered in April 1993. Leona McGovern, she was 22. She was murdered in June 1995. Tracy Wilde, she was 21 and she was murdered in November 1997. And police identified Taylor as a suspect in an attempted murder of a 27-year-old Glasgow sex worker, Alison Wallace, in July 2000. So there is a strong possibility that what we are dealing with, where John Taylor is concerned, is somebody who's got away with murder, potentially for two decades. It'll be interesting to see whether any cases are indeed fully solved in the next decade as new technologies evolve and as perpetrators are incarcerated so they cannot do any damage, but that diligent work can take place to hopefully answer the questions that families have over the people that they loved and lost, finally having those killers who took their lives brought to justice. The thing about DNA is these individuals, it's about time catching up with them. They will get caught. It's just when. Without a doubt, John Taylor is a serial sexual sadist, predator and killer. And in my opinion, without a doubt, he is a serial killer. And if he hadn't been caught the way he was, let's be honest, he would have carried on again and again and again. Leanne was a gorgeous young girl. She had a life ahead of her. She was loved by everybody who knew her. No one's going to say that about John Taylor. And let's be clear, while she'll be flying high in bliss, surrounded in love, one day to be reunited by all those who miss her and love her so, John Taylor, well, I imagine there's going to be some fun in store for him when he takes his last breath. I imagine all those dogs whose skulls he caved in may get a little bit of fun before the DEVIL drags him off for an eternity of hellfire and damnation.
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.